Chapter 26. Pitt steered the big Duesenberg over a narrow driveway between two homes with brick walls entirely blanketed with climbing ivy. He stopped the car in front of a spacious carriage house that fronted an expansive courtyard that was now roofed over.
"Who lives here?" asked Julia.
"A very interesting character," Pitt replied. He motioned toward a large bronze knocker on the door cast in the shape of a sailing ship. "Give it a rap, if you can."
"If you can?"
Her hand reached for the knocker hesitantly.
"Is there a trick to it?"
"Not what you're thinking. Go ahead, try to lift it." But before Julia could touch the knocker, the door was swept open, revealing a huge roly-poly man dressed in burgundy paisley silk pajamas under a matching robe. Julia gasped and took a step backward, bumping into Pitt, who was laughing. "He never fails."
"Fails to do what?"
demanded the fat man. "Open the door before a visitor knocks."
"Oh, that!"
The big man waved airily.
"A chime sounds whenever someone comes up the drive."
"St. Julian," said Pitt. "Forgive the late visit."
"Nonsense," boomed the man, who weighed 400 pounds if he weighed an ounce. "You're welcome any hour of the day or night. Who's the lovely little lady?"
"Julia Lee, may I present St. Julian Perlmutter, gourmet, collector of fine wines, and possessor of the world's largest library on shipwrecks." Perlmutter bowed as far as his bulk allowed and kissed Julia's hand.
"Always a pleasure to meet a friend of Dirk's."
He stood back and swept out an arm, the silk sleeve flapping like a flag in a stiff breeze.
"Don't stand out there in the night. Come in, come in. I was just about to open a bottle of 40-year-old Barrow's Port. Please share it with me."
Julia stepped from the enclosed courtyard that once served to harness teams of horses to fancy carriages, and gazed enraptured at the thousands of books that were massed over every square inch of open space inside the carriage house. Many were neatly spaced on endless shelves. Others were piled along the walls, upstairs, and on balconies. In bedrooms, bathrooms, closets, they were even clustered in the kitchen and dining room. There was barely enough room for a person to walk through a hallway. They were so thickly stacked. Over 50 years, St. Julian Perlmutter had accumulated the finest and most extensive collection of historical ship literature ever assembled in one place. His library was the envy of every maritime archive in the world, and second to none. What books and ship records he could not possess, he painstakingly copied. Fearful of fire or destruction, his fellow researchers pleaded with him to put his immense archive online, but he preferred to leave his collection in bound paper. He generously shared it all without cost to anyone who came to his front door seeking information on a particular shipwreck. As long as Pitt had known him, Perlmutter had never turned down anyone who sought his extensive knowledge. If the staggering hoard of books wasn't a colossal sight, Perlmutter was. Julia gazed openly at him. His face, turned crimson from a lifetime of excessive good food and drink, barely showed under a curly mass of gray hair and a thick, heavy beard. His nose, under the sky-blue eyes, was a little red knob. His lips were lost under a mustache twisted at the ends. He was obese, but not sloppy fat. No flab hung. He was solid as a massive wood sculpture. Most people who first met him thought he was probably much younger than he looked. But St. Julian Perlmutter was a year past 70, and as hearty as they came. A close friend of Pitt's father, Senator George Pitt, Perlmutter had known Dirk almost from the time he was born. Over the years, they had formed a close bond to the point where Perlmutter was like a favorite uncle. He sat Pitt and Julia down around a huge latticed hatch cover, reconstructed and lacquered to as high a sheen as a dining table's. He offered them crystal glasses that had once graced the first-class dining room of the former Italian luxury liner, the Andrea Doria. Julia studied the etched image of the ship on her glass, as Perlmutter poured the aged port.
I thought the Andrea Doria rested on the bottom of the sea.
She still does, said Perlmutter, twisting one end of the gray hair flowing from his lips. Dirk here brought up a rack of wine glasses during a dive he made on the wreck 5 years ago, and graciously gave them to me. Please tell me what you think of the port.
Julia was flattered that such a gourmet would want her opinion. She sipped the ruby contents of the glass and made an expression of delight.
It tastes wonderful.
Good, good.
He gave Pitt a look reserved for a derelict on a park bench.
You, I won't ask, since your taste runs to the mundane.
Pitt acted as if he was insulted.
You wouldn't know good port if you drowned in it, while I, on the other hand, was weaned on it. I hate myself for ever letting you through the front door, Perlmutter moaned.
Julia saw through the charade.
Do you two always go on like this?
Only when we meet, Pitt said, laughing. What brings you here this time of night? Asked Perlmutter, winking at Julia. It couldn't have been my witty conversation.
No, Pitt agreed. It was to see if you ever heard of a ship that left China sometime around 1948 with a cargo of historical Chinese art and then vanished. Perlmutter held the port in front of his eyes and swirled it around in his glass. His eyes took on a reflective expression as his encyclopedic mind delved into his brain cells.
I seem to recall that the name of the ship was the Princess Doan. She went missing with all hands somewhere off Central America. No trace of ship or crew was ever found.
Was there a record of her cargo?
Perlmutter shook his head. The word that she was carrying a rich cargo of antiquities came from unsubstantiated reports only. Vague rumors, actually. No evidence ever came to light to suggest it was true.
How do you call it? Asked Pitt.
Another mystery of the sea. There is very little I can tell you except the Princess Doan was a passenger ship that had seen her day and was scheduled for the scrapyard. A pretty ship. In her prime, she was known as the Queen of the China Sea.
Then how did she end up lost off Central America? Perlmutter shrugged.
As I said, another mystery of the sea.
Pitt shook his head vigorously.
I disagree. If there is an enigma, it is man-made. A ship simply doesn't vanish 5,000 miles from where she is supposed to be. Let me dig out the record on the Princess. I believe it's in a book stacked under the piano.
He lifted his bulk off a thankful chair and ambled out of the dining room. In less than 2 minutes, Pitt and Julia heard his voice roar out through the hall from another room.
Ah, here it is!
With all these books, he knows exactly where to find the one he's looking for, she asked in amazement.
He can tell you the title of every book in the house, said Pitt with certainty. Its exact location and what number it lies from the top of its stack or from the right side of its shelf.
Pitt had no sooner finished speaking than Perlmutter came into the room, his elbows brushing both frames of the doorway simultaneously.
He held up a thick, leather-bound book. The title, lettered in gold, read, History of the Orient Shipping Lines.
This is the only official record I've ever come across on the Princess Doan that gives details of her years afloat.
Perlmutter sat down at the table, opened the book, and began reading aloud.
She was laid down and launched in the same year, 1913, by Harland and Wolfe Shipbuilders of Belfast for the Singapore Pacific Steamship Lines. Her original name was Lanai. Gross tonnage of just under 11,000 tons, overall length of 497 feet, and a 60-foot beam. She was rather a good-looking ship for her day.
He paused and held up the book to show a photograph of the ship sailing over a flat sea with a trailing wisp of smoke from her single smokestack. The photo was tinted and revealed the traditional black hull with white superstructure topped by a tall green funnel.
She could carry 510 passengers, 55 of them first class," Perlmutter continued. "She was originally coal-fired, but converted to oil-firing in 1920. Top speed of 17 knots. A maiden voyage took place in December of 1913, when she left Southampton for Singapore. Until 1931, most of her voyages were between Singapore and Honolulu."
"It must have been a comfortable and relaxing experience sailing across the South Seas in those early days," said Julia. "Passengers were not nearly so harried and occupied 80 years ago," Pitt agreed. He looked at Perlmutter. "When did the Lanai become the Princess Do Wan?"
"She was sold to the Canton Lines out of Shanghai in 1931, Perlmutter answered. "From then until the war, she carried passengers and cargo to ports around the South China Sea. During the war, she served as an Australian troop transport. In 1942, while unloading troops and their equipment off New Guinea, she was attacked by Japanese aircraft and severely damaged, but she returned to Sydney under her own power for repair and a refit. Her war record is quite impressive. From 1940 to 1945, she transported over 80,000 men in and out of the war zone, dodging enemy aircraft, submarines, and warships, and suffering extensive damage inflicted during 7 different attacks."
5 years of sailing through Japanese-infested waters," said Pitt. "It's a wonder she wasn't sunk."
"When the war ended, the Princess Do Wan was returned to the Canton Lines and refitted as a passenger ship again. She then went into service between Hong Kong and Shanghai. Then, in the late fall of 1948, she was taken out of service and sent to the scrappers in Singapore for breaking up."
"Breaking up," Pitt echoed. "You said she sank off Central America."
"Her fate gets vague," said Perlmutter, pulling several loose sheets of paper from the book. "I accumulated what information I could find and condensed it into a brief report. All that's known for certain is that she didn't make it to the scrappers. The final account came from a naval station radio operator at Valparaiso, Chile. According to the radio operator's records, a ship calling herself the Princess Do Wan sent out a series of distress signals, saying she was taking on water and badly listing under a violent storm 200 miles west. Repeated inquiries brought no answers. Then her radio went dead and she was never heard from again. A search turned up no sign of her."
"Could there have been another Princess Do Wan?" asked Julia.
Perlmutter shook his head negatively. "The International Ships Registry only lists one Princess Do Wan between 1850 and the present. The signal must have been sent as a red herring from another Chinese vessel."
"Where did the rumor originate that Chinese antiquities were on board?" asked Pitt. Perlmutter held out his hands, palms upward, in a sign of unknowing.
"A myth? A legend? The sea is full of them. The only sources I'm aware of were unreliable dock workers and nationalist Chinese soldiers who were in charge of loading the ship. They were later captured and interrogated by the communists. One claimed a crate broke open while it was being lifted aboard, revealing a life-size bronze prancing horse."
"How on earth did you find all this information?" said Julia, overwhelmed with Perlmutter's knowledge of maritime disasters. He smiled.
"From a fellow researcher in China. I have sources around the world that I rely on to send me books and information related to shipwrecks whenever they find it. They know that I pay top dollar for reports that contain new and uncovered ground. The story of the Princess Do Wan came from an old friend who is China's top historian and researcher by the name of Zhu Quan. We've corresponded and exchanged maritime information for many years. It was he who mentioned a legend surrounding the alleged treasure ship."
"Was Zhu Quan able to give you a manifest of the treasure?" Pitt inquired.
"No, he claimed only that his research led him to believe that before Mao's troops marched into Shanghai, Chiang Kai-shek cleaned out the museums, galleries, and private collections of Chinese antiquities,
Records of art and artifacts before World War II in China are sketchy, to say the least. It is pretty well known that after the communists took over, there were few antiquities to be found. All that you see in China today were discovered and excavated since 1948. Not one of the lost treasures was ever found?
Not to my knowledge, Perlmutter admitted. Nor has Zhu Quan told me any different.
Pitt took the last swallow from his glass of the 40-year-old port. So a vast part of Chinese heritage may lie on the bottom of the sea. Julia's expression altered to curiosity.
This is almost interesting, but I fail to see what any of this has to do with Qin Shang's illegal immigrant smuggling operations.
Pitt took her hand and held it tightly. Your Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation can strike Qin Shang and his rotten empire from the front and sides. But his obsession with the lost antiquities of China opens the door for the National Underwater and Marine Agency to strike him from the rear, where he least expects it. St. Julian and I will have to play catch-up, but we're very good at what we do. Together, we make a better search team than any Qin Shang can put together. Pitt paused, and his expression lightened. Now the only trick we have to perform is to find the Princess Do Wan before Qin Shang.